Dr. Brad Stauffer, Eel 3.
Yeah. So I went to Mons 4, and I said, what did you discuss on that occasion? And he said, I really can't remember. But then he said, but never mind, I can tell you something else which only he and I know. And that will satisfy him. And so I came back and said, Mons 4 says he can't remember what he said to you on that occasion, which we discussed. But he told me to tell you this. And he said, oh, well, that's all right. Then it's fine. And now I shall give you class, and you're not allowed to pay anything. On the contrary, I'll give you money, and I'll support, and please accept money. Of course, I'm very pleased to be involved in any way I can to help resistance. And later on, he, in fact, had to go underground himself, but much later on he became a well-known cartoonist for the resistance movement, this oculist. But
what was his name?
Östergaard. Well, now it was decided that my job from now on should be to be responsible for the Free Denmark resistance groups in central and northern Jutland, so that I had my center in Aarhus, which of course is the capital of Jutland, and I should every month travel and have contact with local groups which had meanwhile been established in 25, 26, 28 different parts of towns in Jutland, and try to strengthen them and give them moral support by coming with information from Copenhagen and so on. That was my job, and then I was given a free card to the travel card to the Danish railways, so that I could travel anywhere with, of course, a false, and I had a false identity card, all the identity papers. I even had a driving license, although I never driven a car, but I meant to have as many official papers as possible. This was organized all. And so I traveled around, and I had my center in Aarhus, and I had contact already there, a consultant in orthopedic hospital, and I stayed with him in his apartment in the hospital to begin with. But that became too risky after a while. We shouldn't both be in the same place in case one was arrested. The other should not necessarily be arrested as well.
What is his name?
Egerholm. A-G-E-R-H-O-L-M. Egerholm Christensen. He later, after the war, he went to England as an orthopedic surgeon. But he was arrested after a while, but managed to escape to Sweden. He simulated a heart attack and managed to get out of a window from the lavatory and so on in the prison, and got away and got to Sweden, and then he got to England later on. So my cooperation with him didn't go on for very long, but I had quickly established a number of contacts in Aarhus, and had now addresses practically everywhere. I never wrote down any names or addresses. I mean, I had my private computer here. I knew all these names and all the addresses. I never wrote anything down.
You just committed everything to memory?
completely. Completely to memory. And it worked. And of course, I could also, any time if I was, if I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and somebody asked me, what is your name? I could give my false name. It was not the same name as I used in the resistance. I had the name of a genuine, of a man who was an accountant and was about my age. I'd never met him. But he had volunteered to give his name and his identity. He couldn't take any part in himself, but anybody could use that. So that if I was arrested, the name I would give to the police or to the Gestapo or whoever it was would be the name of a real person.
Who was he? What was his name?
His name was... his name was...
Doesn't matter. No. It will come to you later.
Yeah, I'll come to... I could say when he was born, I could give his address and so on. I can't give it now, of course. But I could give that at any time. But the others was the other name, Sander, was kept for resistance purposes, so they wouldn't mix the names up in that way. And in Aarhus, I had contact with some undergraduates. Jan Kieler was one of them. He was a young undergraduate from Horsens, south of Aarhus. And I had contact with him, and also when I came to his town, Horsens, I stayed with his parents. His father was a doctor, and they were very keen resistance people, and very glad to help in any way they could. There was a whole network established in Germany. And I visited...
In Germany?
No, oh, sorry, in Jutland, I mean. In Jutland, not in Germany. In Jutland. And I paid regular visits once a month to every center, but not to the sub-centers. They gave the information for me, passed it on. But it was quite a huge district from the north of... the tip of Jutland down to a central line, so that only the southern part of Jutland was looked after by somebody else who changing traveling secretaries. So that kept me pretty busy, but also once, at least once a month, I was due to go to Copenhagen and meet with the Committee of Free Denmark, Professor Vogns Fogh, Bo Holman, and other members who had now been enrolled in the after the arrest of some of them. So there was a committee, and they arranged that the editorial meetings should take place while I was there, so that we met all together, and I contributed some articles. For instance, yesterday there was an article in Politiken quoting an article, an underground article by me about the western coast of Jutland in connection with what's happening now in Normandy, where I described the conditions. Of course, not my name was not mentioned. No name were given in these papers. But anyway, so I took part in that, and therefore had regular contact. And after the, well, I must just mention that the person I had the closest contact with was Professor Fo, who became, after a while, the central figure of the Danish resistance movement. I mean, everybody knew his name. And his open letters, which had been duplicated and sent around, and I mean, he became sort of a key figure. And in September 43, the freedom, the Danish Freedom Council was established, joining together all the movements into one leadership. And there in that leadership, Mogens Fog represented Frit Danmark. Bo Holman represented the Communist Party. And one man, Frode Jacobsen, represented something called the Ring, which had started as an information, as an informative group with local groups established. He traveled around. So he was there, and a man called Arne Sørensen, who represented a political party which was a super nationalistic party, but absolutely and utterly against the German occupation. He represented that. And then there were some people representing more or less themselves. But that, from then on, this Freedom Council was the official leadership of the total resistance movement in Denmark. And it prevented internal strife and also actions which should not be permitted. I mean, we were against, and they declared themselves clearly against, say, murdering individual German soldiers. This was not the way to carry out the resistance movement, terror actions and such things. But sabotage, yes, and so on. But at the beginning, I mean, after I had volunteered now to devote my entire life and my entire time to this, I stayed in the north of Copenhagen with a friend of mine, a Danish playwright called Kjell Abel. He said, you can always stay here with him and his wife. They had a guest room, and I stayed there when I was in Copenhagen. And then I had contact with Mogens Fog, who was underground but also lived nearby. I didn't know his address, but he knew mine. He knew, because he knew Kjell Abel, not personally, but they got to know each other later on. But then on the 29th of April, 43, I had been on my first visit, my first tour in Jutland, and I was coming back now to Copenhagen again and stayed with Abel and had contact with Fog. And then at 5 o'clock next morning, and this was a crucial night, 29th of April 43, when the Germans took complete power in Denmark and the Danish government resigned. And we'd been sitting discussing the situation. We knew that there was an ultimatum from the Germans to the Danish government and hoped that they would reject it, hoped that they would not make another compromise. But of course, we knew nothing. But we knew that this situation was serious. So we went to bed about midnight. At 5 o'clock, or 4:30, Kjell Abel came into my guest room and said, "Elias, you've got to get up. The Germans are on their way here. They are arresting and a friend of his who was a literary critic had just been arrested, and his wife had telephoned Abel and said, there are German lorries driving around arresting people. And it seems that it's sort of well-known people who are being arrested. Well-known people who's supposed to be anti-German. So she said, I think that they are on their way to you now, probably. So you better be prepared or decide whether you want to run away. Which he didn't do. He said, they're taking hostages. And therefore, I'm not being arrested for anything else. But, and I think it's important that I should stay as a hostage. But you must go, he said, because you are already on the blacklist. And it would be dangerous for you if they found you here. So I had to get up quickly, dress, and when I was tying my tie, the Germans rang the bell to come in. So I, fortunately, it was the Wehrmacht, not the Gestapo. And if it had been Gestapo, they surrounded the house. But this was not a sort of police action in that way. And therefore, they didn't think of surrounding the house. And so I rushed out through the French windows, through the garden and the fence. I jumped over the fence and ran away.
What was the date of this?
29th of August, 43. I think they arrested altogether 300 prominent hostages who were sent to the camp where the communists had previously been and which was now empty. So they were taken there, and they were all sorts of, they were many of them wealthy people, and some of them were professors, and I mean all sorts of people together. But all of them, none of them friendly to the Germans. And they were held there for, 6, 7, 8 weeks. Then they were released again. Because they were not accused of anything. It was simply a way of saying, now we have these people here, if you do anything, we'll do something to them. But the result was that my contact with Montfort had been broken, because he knew where I was, and he knew that Caleb had been arrested now. So he sent his girlfriend over, clad as a sort of a saleswoman with a basket, and coming to this house. They didn't know whether Germans would be there. They knew that he had been arrested. They thought that his wife might still be there, but it was possible, of course. They didn't know whether I had been arrested. So she came there with a basket and pretended to sell potatoes or other things, fruit. And so when the door was opened by Mrs. Abel to be safe, she lifted a big potato, and under that was a note saying, "Where's Sandor?" And so she could say, the wife could say, "Come in, it's all clear. My husband's been taken, but Sandor has left a message that if you contact so-and-so, he will know where he will be." So it was re-established again in that way. Because that could be dangerous if you suddenly, I couldn't get at him and he couldn't get at me until I had given some information, some person with whom I could lodge information. So this is how it went on. And I now lived in Jutland. I had to move from place to place. I mean, Jutland was my permanent address, and I traveled to all the other places, and many of them I stayed overnight. Sometimes I stayed in hotels, and if possible, I always chose hotels where there were German officers living, because I felt safer there, because it was unthinkable that a resistance man would move in with a hotel full of Germans. So I felt that as a sort of safe precaution, strangely enough. But otherwise, I was billeted privately, and people were wonderful. Married couple would move out of their beds and say, "You stay here, and we'll live on mattresses," because I mean they were so happy to do something in this situation to a person. I mean, there weren't many persons at that time permanently living on the ground. There were later on, but not yet at that time. And of course, I had credentials with these people, and this was important. And it was a very mixed crowd of people. There were parsons, there were dentists, there were doctors, there were clericals, there were housewives, all sorts of people I had contact with. I was invited up to the bishop's palace in Aarhus, because his two sons had been in the resistance movement, and through some others he'd heard about Sandor and had said they would like to see me. So I became a frequent guest in the bishop's palace there. I hadn't the faintest idea who I really was, but I mean, they knew that I was right, and I was Sandor, and they even went so far as to invite me to their silver wedding, but I refused. The pretense should be that I was the bishop's cousin, and I said, "Well, that's mechanic, but I dare not do it. There might be people there. I cannot take risks of such a kind." So I never accepted that. So in a way, everything went normally, but we expanded all the time. And it was important that the monthly paper should circulate as much as possible and be run off with duplicators, or even better, printed. And I was very keen to get, I mean, we had had a printing firm in Zealand, so that it had been printed, but the man had been taken, one of these cases where he couldn't help boasting a little about it, and that, of course, was fatal. As soon as people knew that, he said, I won't say anything, I may know something about that, and that was too much. So I contacted a printer in Aarhus, a little private printer who had some of these small machines which run off so many. And I knew that he was a very keen, but also he said, it's too dangerous. I can only do it if you provide the lead material. Because if I use my own, in no time they can say, this was printed here. These lead types are too individual, and you can, by some, in some way, prove that this was done in a certain printing press and not in another. So, in another place, they simply held up a Nazi printer during the daytime while the Germans were outside, pulled down the blinds and dismantled everything and took it out onto lorries, and the Germans watched it and thought, well, this man's moving and so on. Nothing happened. This was not, I couldn't do that. We had no chance. But I suddenly heard of a printer in Horsens, in fact, the town Keeler came from, where a printer had to sell everything. And I arranged a meeting with him and bought it. He didn't know for what purpose. And then we had our own printing material. And this we managed to establish, and I had contact with two communist, what do you call them, people who said...
Typographers.
Who were willing, but they wanted, they drew up a plan, we must have these enormous big things, and they weigh a lot with all the types, where they immediately know this is A and this is B and so on, but it's not arranged according to that. And they must be...